We want to talk about a timely book, a devastating satire of American suburban life. Its sameness, its shallowness, perhaps its soullessness. The book came out in 22, that is, 1922. 100 years ago, Sinclair Lewis published the novel Babbitt. It was so influential, so controversial. And years later, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1930. And today, it remains in the canon of great American books. We're joined now to talk about this by Sally Perry. She's founding president of the Sinclair Lewis Society and professor emeritus of literature at Illinois State University. Sally, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to splice in some sound of Babbitt from the LA Theater Works production that played on member station KCRW in 1987. The LA Theater Works kindly gave us access to the audio. But first of all, Babbitt, why is it a defining work?
Well, I think that it captured a period in time. In the 1920s, America was all about business. Most of the presidents of the time, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, thought that the business of America was business. And so for Sinclair Lewis to focus on an average businessman for his novel, I think struck a real chord.
Yeah, and it's still so relevant today. So let's go into the story. The main character is a middle-aged man, George Babbitt. He's 46, successful commercial real estate broker in this fictitious town named Zenith. And here is an excerpt about his material stuff that is quite telling.
These standard advertised wares, toothpaste, socks, tires, cameras, instantaneous hot water heaters, were his symbols and proofs of excellence. At first the signs, then the substitutes, for joy and passion and wisdom.
Wow. The substitutes for joy and passion. What is going on in George Babbitt's life here?
The received wisdom is that Babbitt is just a very soulless businessman, very middle class, very boring, and so forth. And what Lewis does that I think is very telling, he has Babbitt have this wonderful sort of internal life in which there's a lot more excitement than there is in his outer life. So although he's driving a car to work, like many, many people do, on the other hand, it's kind of like he's taking an adventure. In his mind, he describes his office as being like going onto a pirate ship. Now, he's basically just driving downtown to the office. But for Babbitt, the best way for him to deal with such a standardized society and a standardized expectation of what he should be doing is to have this wonderful internal life where he has adventures.
And yet this external side of him is clearly mocked and satirized by Sinclair Lewis. It's easy for us to mock, but this stuff is, back then, the social currency of the day. And how different is it from today?
Not all that different. I mean, there are a couple of exchanges that Babbitt has with friends and neighbors and so forth. And he'll say something, it's amplified by the next person, amplified by somebody else. And you can certainly see it in our social media today. Somebody says something and it gets memed all over the place. And Babbitt thinks he's being kind of original, but it's not. It's sort of the received wisdom that's passed on by different kinds of social media. I know in that time period, it would have been radio and newspapers and magazines as opposed to Twitter and Facebook today. But it's the same kind of amplification of what you're expected to think.
Yeah. So George Babbitt, at some point in this book, realizes life is mechanical. There's a phrase in the book describing it as brittle pretentiousness. Here's another quick excerpt.
It was coming to him that perhaps all life as he knew it and vigorously practiced it was futile. That heaven, as portrayed by the Reverend Dr. John Jennison Drew, was neither probable nor very interesting. That he hadn't much pleasure out of making money. That it was of doubtful worth to rear children, merely that they might rear children who would rear children. What was it all about? What did he want?
We ask that question ourselves, right? What is it all about? And as George Babbitt is asking these questions, this kind of veneer starts to fall apart, doesn't it? His best friend goes to prison. Babbitt becomes obsessed chasing women. The veneer of this suburban life starts to fall apart, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, in that sense, the novel moves from a critique of standardized businessman to a sort of a midlife crisis novel. So much of what he's taken pleasure in and kind of found his place in gets upended once the friend shoots his wife in despair, basically. And it makes Babbitt think that, well, you know, his marriage isn't doing so well either, and his friends are pretty superficial friends. There must be more to life than this. And you're right, he tries to date women, and it's not very successful with one exception. And he comes into contact with Tanis Judique, a slightly younger widow, and her friends, the Bunch. And the Bunch, they gossip, they go out drinking, they do all sorts of fun things. But George is 46, and it's hard to maintain that pace when, you know, you're at a different stage in life than they are.
Yeah. So he kind of jumps into this bohemian life. He has this affair with this woman, Tanis. And then it comes at a cost, where he gets rejected by his old social clubs, neighbors. And then George Babbitt, he wants back in. But Babbitt slings one last dagger at this suburban society. His son goes bohemian. He elopes with his girlfriend. He wants to quit college. Gasp. And Babbitt, here voiced by Edward Asner in the LA Theater Works production, he tells his son, I think you should go for it.
I've never done a single thing I wanted to in my whole life. I don't know as I've accomplished anything except just get along. I figure out I've made about a quarter of an inch out of a possible 100 rods. Well, maybe you'll carry things on further. I don't know. But I do get a kind of sneaking pleasure out of the fact that you knew what you wanted to do and did it. Well, those folks in there will try to bully you and tame you down. Tell them to go to the devil.
Oof. Tell them to go to the devil. You know, that's on the last page. What do you make of this ending? What is it telling us in 1922, in 2022?
I think there's several things going on. One is, although he comes back with a sort of sadder but wiser, and because his wife was near death with appendicitis, coming back to the comfort of his friends and his family and so forth is comforting. But on the other hand, he has a realization that he's never going to be the liberal lawyer or the friend of the poor that he thought he would be. So he's looking towards the next generation. Many of Lewis's middle-aged characters, once they come to the realization that the world is not going to be the way that they want it to be, nor are they going to do everything that they wanted to do, they keep hoping that maybe the next generation, it will be better, it will be different. But knowing Lewis, it's always ambivalent. And I think that's what makes Lewis so fascinating to this day, is that he'll say something or the character will say something and it sounds very positive. Yet at the same time, there's this undercurrent of sadness that I'd like to think this is true, but I'm not sure it is going to be true.
Yeah. And the book ends with us not exactly knowing, but George Babbitt kind of urging his son to be different in the next generation. Yeah. So many people in middle age or otherwise, at one point or another, many of us have asked the way George Babbitt did, am I sleepwalking through life? You know, it made me think about a donut with these fancy sprinkles, fancy on the outside, hollow in the middle. What is your sense of Sinclair Lewis's answer to that question? Does he have one?
I'm not sure he does. Lewis as a person always wanted to do more. And you can see that in his lifestyle, his moving from Minnesota to New York. He also went to Europe numerous times. He didn't like to stay put. He was kind of impatient with American society, kind of impatient with the world. He thought that the potential for American society was wonderful. And he was very patriotic in that sense. But the reality of American society was not. And trying to reconcile the dream of a wonderful American society with what actually exists and what Americans are actually able to accomplish was something that bedeviled him his entire life.
Yes, was he quoted as saying something like, I love America, but I don't like it?
Yes. And, you know, variations on that come up over and over again. And as I said, it's this ambivalence towards not only his characters and the situations in which they find themselves, whether we're talking business or medicine or religion or whatnot, but why people don't take advantage of all the wonderful things that exist in society. There's a late novel, King's Blood Royal, in which one of his main character finds out that he has a black ancestor. And he finds this interesting. He's ostracized from his family. He's basically evicted from the housing development where he lives. He loses his job and so forth. And for Lewis, who did mountains and mountains of research for all of his novels, that was very telling that even for somebody like Neil Kingsblood, who was a decorated war veteran, that once you kind of turn the corner and make a choice, that society isn't going to necessarily be kind to you. It's going to lash back.
Yeah. And that is Sally Perry, professor emeritus at Illinois State University and founding president of the Sinclair Lewis Society. Sally, thanks so much for the time.
Oh, thank you. I always like to talk about Lewis.
And special thanks to LA Theater Works for giving us access to the radio play of Babbitt, starring Edward Asner, with Susan Albert Lowenberg as producing director.